meaning you may end up without enough cells in your lungs or liver or kidney or anywhere else for that matter. Lack of these progenitor cells equals less repaired organs. That's especially important as you age, because progenitor cells are also prone to oxidative stress, making your P53 even more dangerous. In a perfect world, you'd be able to train the perfect guard dog, kill the cancers, and let the progenitor cells through. But P53 doesn't always follow our ideal model. Sometimes it's not active enough, which increases your risk of cancer. And sometimes it's more aggressive than a German shepherd with its crosshairs and a drug smuggler, increasing your risk of dying from frailty. In the grand scheme of aging, our ultimate goal may be to strike a balance so that we can turn down our P53s a notch or two, just enough to reduce the risk of frailty that comes with an overactive one, but not so much as to leave us at an increased risk of developing cancer.
U-tips. While wide open frontier of medicine is finding cures for cancers, our job in the meantime is to avoid getting them in the first place. Of course, genetics play a large role, but that doesn't mean you're simply a card in a game of cancerous blackjack. The main thing you can do to decrease your chances of cancer is reduce the repetitive injury to your normal cells, so there's less a chance that P53 will make a mistake and allow cancer to kill off a weakened but necessary cell and then grow and spread. How do you do that? By being aware and taking steps to protect yourself against many of the major agers that we have already discussed. In addition, take these steps to help prevent the birth and spread of cancer cells. U-tip. Get the aspirin advantage. One of the greatest things you can do for your health takes literally a half second. Taking 162 milligrams of aspirin a day, that's two baby aspirin or half a regular, taken with a half a glass of warm water before and after, can decrease the risk of getting colon cancer, esophageal, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, and breast cancer, all by 40%. And it probably decreases the risk of stomach, throat, and several other cancers as well. Aspirin provides this through the reduction of inflammation throughout the body, although other cell repair mechanisms may be active as well. We know aspirin has side effects, but the benefits, a younger arterial system and a decreased risk of at least four big cancers, often outweigh the risks. So discuss with your doc whether it's worth it to you. U-tip, fortify yourself with D. Vitamin D decreases the risk of cancer, perhaps because it's toxic to cancer cells. The other theory is that D bolsters the ability of the guard dog P53 gene to spot cancerous cells and kill them. Most Americans don't get enough D because we're indoors most of the time, and when we're outdoors, we're wearing sunscreen. We recommend getting 800 IU a day if you're younger than 60 and 1,000 international units if you're over 60. You can do it with supplements of food, though you probably won't get more than 300 or so IUs through food alone, so supplementation is smart. Getting some sunlight is also protective. You can't get enough sun in most of the U.S. and all of Canada between October 1st and April 15th to turn inactive vitamin D into active vitamin D. So we recommend you get insurance D and food supplement with vitamin D3 or in supplements. Don't get more than 2,000 international units a day. U-tip, protect your liver. Since your liver is your main detox organ, you're smart to keep it performing at its best. Certain foods and supplements can help improve liver function and have anti-cancer properties. Liver detox systems are enhanced by broccoli sprouts, seaweed, and dark greens, and are proven to reduce the risk of cancer at various sites, including the prostate, lung, breast, and colon. Other things that have been shown to improve liver health include choline, which can be found in cruciferous vegetables, as well as N-acetylcysteine at 500 milligrams per day, milk thistle, 200 milligrams per day, lecithin, 1 tablespoon daily, and rosemary extract, 150 milligrams per day. U-tip, B be protected. Research shows that deficiency of folate, part of the B complex of vitamins, is linked to cancer. Folate supplementations decreases colon cancer rates by 20 to 50%, but more than 50% of Americans don't get the recommended amount, and 90% don't get the amount that seems to reduce colon cancer, 800 micrograms a day. Lots of food, like spinach, tomatoes, and orange juice, contain folate, but it's absorbed less well than folic acid from supplements. The average intake of folate through food is 275 to 375 micrograms, so you need a supplement of about 400 micrograms to reduce your risk of cancer. That's especially important if you're allowing sun exposure to deplete your folate levels, which happens when you get more than 20 minutes of sun exposure a day. Be sure to add B6 and crystalline B12 as well. U-tip, tee it up. Green tea has been shown to have the highest concentration of polyphenols, which are chemicals with potent antioxidant properties believed to be greater than even vitamin C. They give tea its bitter flavor. Because green tea leaves are young and have not been oxidized, green tea has up to 40% polyphenols, while black tea contains only about 10%. Another interesting note, green tea has one-third the caffeine of black tea. Even better, it's been shown to yield the same level of excitement and attentiveness, but in more even levels than the ups and downs associated with other caffeinated drinks. Just don't drink milk with it. The casein in milk has been shown to inhibit the beneficial effects of tea.
Chapter 6. Breathe Easy. You don't have to be a phone sex operator to know that there are times when heavy breathing feels pretty darn good. Like when you're playing a sport that you love, or fooling around with someone you love. But when it comes to heavy breathing, the question really is how to differentiate between the sensation that goes with exercise and sex, and one that's associated with a chronic medical problem. Like pain, breathlessness can be difficult to describe. But we certainly know the extreme example. No breath, no life. Somewhere in the middle, between having no air and breathing in clear, rich, and wonderful air, you can live in a respiratory world of coughing, wheezing, and struggling to get the oxygen you need. The reason why lung disease is one of the top 6 causes of aging is that we are continually renewing the very thin and sensitive cells in the lungs so that we can exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide. As the stem cells that regenerate these cells start to slow down, the renewal process lags. And the lungs scar, a process called fibrosis, and become resistant to air exchange. The major ager of shortened telomeres also slows down our stem cells, so the damage is compounded. Now, one of the most common complaints with aging is shortness of breath. Much of this is caused by changes in the elasticity of the lung, so it takes more effort to bring in air, and by physiological changes in your lungs that make breathing harder. Much of this happens because of the major ager of toxins in our environment, like the secondhand smoke and pollution, which pass into us most easily in the air we breathe, which is several liters per minute. The rate of aging of the lungs is, in fact, greater than the aging of the heart. So while some shortness of breath is associated with cardiac troubles, that's not always the case, and breathing problems can indeed originate from the lungs. Your lungs. Breathing easy. One of the best ways to understand lungs and breathlessness is by understanding the relationship between what comes in, which is oxygen, and what goes out, which is carbon dioxide, and how your lungs handle each. To see how that relationship works, let's look at exercise. Muscles working hard during exercise need more oxygen, and they also produce more carbon dioxide. Special cells in the main arteries and brainstem detect these levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide, and these send signals to the brain and heart to increase breathing and pulse rates. This means that more blood is pumped throughout the body, picking up more carbon dioxide from the muscles to be released in the lungs to be breathed out, and picking up more oxygen there to deliver to the muscles. In a healthy person, physical fitness determines the point at which you experience breathlessness. The more regular physical exercise your body is used to, the more efficient your muscles are. They'll use oxygen better and create less carbon dioxide. And the lungs and heart will end up being more efficient too. That's why a fit person can do more exercise without getting breathless than an unfit person can. How does that relate to lung disease? Well, certain illnesses can mimic the effects of being unfit, but unfortunately at much lower levels of exertion than simple exercise. So that even crossing a room, getting the mail, or doing a lap around the coffee table can lead to major huffing and puffing. One of the key players in lung health is the vagus nerve. When the lung expands during normal shallow breathing, that stimulates the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve then sends a message to the brain to constrict the bronchi, making breathing more difficult. That's really one of the reasons why deep breathing helps deep breathing. Meditation functionally serves to physiologically cut the vagus, so it disrupts the feedback loop of bronchial constriction, allowing you to breathe easier. And that's crucial. Deep nasal breathing isn't just for yoga rooms and massage tables. Deep breathing helps transport to your lungs a gas called nitric oxide, a very potent lung and blood vessel dilator that resides in your nasal passages. And since it's located in the highest concentration in the back of your nose, deep breathing is also one of the best ways to increase nitric oxide to help your lungs and blood vessels open up better and function more efficiently. Essentially, taking deep breaths helps your lungs go from 97% saturation of oxygen to 100% saturation of oxygen. And that little 3% can sometimes make a big difference in how you feel. While we're certainly concerned about how you breathe in, we're also concerned about what you breathe in. As one of only three ways the inside of your body interacts with the outside world, your lungs can be exposed to a great deal of nasty toxins. The outdoor pollutants that mostly affect your lung health appear to be ozone, carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and lead. Others include dioxins, asbestos, and particulate matter. Those are the particles produced by the combustion of diesel, gasoline, and other fuels, as well as tobacco smoke. Air pollution caused by particulate matter so small that it can't be seen is what aggravates and leads to respiratory and cardiovascular problems, and even death. How? Particles from the polluted air that are too small to be filtered out by the cilia travel deep into the lungs. Though the immune system responds to those foreign particles, those particles do a number on the immune system, allowing infections to occur and asthma to develop. Many people are rats in someone else's experiment if they live close to a freeway where small particles roam the air and increase lung problems, especially for young children and their stay-at-home mothers who don't escape to the safety of the workplace. You should also note that a similar damaging effect can happen when you're exposed to indoor pollutants like radon, asbestos, mite dust, and mold. Molds, for instance, produce mycotoxins, which weaken or kill the things they live on or compete with. Short-term exposure can cause breathing problems, and the research indicates that long-term exposure may also be linked to cancer. Our goal here is for you to take the steps necessary to keep your lungs clear and fluffy, so that any heavy breathing you do is associated with having fun, not slowing you down.
U-tips. Of course, you know the cardinal rule for protecting your lungs. No smoking. We're not going to spend much time talking about the dangers of cigarette smoke, because that would be like talking about the dangers of swimming in a shark cage with a bloody nose. It's obvious. But we do want to give you steps you can take to improve your lung health and your breathing. U-tip, take 10. Lie on your back flat on the floor with one hand on your belly and one hand on your chest. I know, it doesn't seem right. Take a deep breath in slowly. Lying on the floor at first when you practice is important, because if you stand up, you're more likely to fake a deep breath by doing an exaggerated chest extension rather than letting it fill up naturally. Imagine your lungs filling up with air. It should take about 5 seconds to inhale. As your diaphragm pulls your chest cavity down, your belly button should move away from your spine as you fill with air. Your chest will also widen and maybe rise ever so slightly as you inhale. When your lungs feel full, exhale slowly, taking about 7 seconds to let the air out. Our recommendation, take 10 deep breaths in the morning, 10 at night, and as many as you need in between to help relieve stress. U-tips, take supplements. Magnesium, a mineral that relaxes the bronchial tubes, can help with asthma. Take 400 milligrams a day. If you routinely produce mucus from your lungs, you cough it up rather than mucus coming out when you blow your nose, which is usually from a sinus condition, consider N-acetylcysteine. It's a substance that loosens mucus and boosts production of one of your natural antioxidant scavengers called glutathione, which helps prevent damage in lung tissue. We recommend 600 milligrams daily. Even caffeine can help people with asthma. It seems to stabilize and shrink the lining of the airways and dilate bronchial tubes to help make breathing easier.
Major ager, glycosylation, how excess glucose can age you. While it sounds like something you order up at Jiffy Lube for $39.95, glycosylation is one of the best examples of a biochemical process that has dramatic physical effects. Simply, glycosylation occurs when sugar molecules, which are glucose, flowing around in your blood attach to protein molecules, diminishing their effectiveness and causing inflammation. This process, which increases as we age, happens so readily that it doesn't even require a specific enzyme to push it ahead. That's also why glycosylation is so dangerous. Normally, glucose is what gives our cells energy. But when we develop insulin resistance, the insulin can't effectively get all the glucose into our cells. If glucose can't get into a cell, it stays in the blood and gunks up the proteins in our body. It's a little bit like acid rain. It damages the things it touches and makes them leaky. When extra glucose latches onto another molecule on the outside of a cell, the extra glucose handcuffs that molecule and prevents it from doing its job well. Even science nicknames the effects of glucose on protein as aging. These glucose-modified proteins are termed advanced glycosylation end products. AGE is an appropriate acronym because they actually age us. The receptors for glycosylated proteins, which are called RAGE, R-A-G-E, are major targets for new drugs to slow down the complications of diabetes, including blindness, kidney damage, nerve damage, and heart disease. Glycosylation messes with your blood pressure. Your body has a way of self-regulating your blood pressure to deal with fluctuations throughout the day. For example, when you exercise, your body knows to dilate certain blood vessels to get more blood to your muscles. When you think, the arteries open up, a little, to your brain. If you get really upset about something, that the dog stained the carpet, the boss piled on more work, or the Dodgers blew a big lead, blood pressure goes up. But while the pressure of blood flow may be up in one area of your body, say near your heart, other parts of your body, say near the kidney, open up the arteries to ease the flow of blood there and keep your overall blood pressure from going bonkers. So instead of 220 over 130, it goes up only to 125 over 82. That balancing act is called autoregulation and keeps your blood pressure relatively normal. But excess blood glucose negates and destroys this autoregulation system, thus taxing your arteries more heavily. Glycosylation causes nerve injury. When glucose gets inside your nerve cells, that causes big molecules to be built. Sorbitol is one, for you crossword whizzes. Not only can't these get out of cells easily, but they attract water to those cells, causing them to get bigger. Big cells may be good for prisoners, but not for your body. Why? Those big nerve cells get compressed by the tight myelin sheath that surrounds them. Kind of like trying to put more tomatoes in that little bitty can. The tomatoes break apart. So eventually, you damage those nerves. That's the long nerve dysfunction that diabetics often get. when they aren't able to sense their feet normally. This is called stocking glove nerve dysfunction. You lose sensation in all areas covered by a stocking or a glove. Peripheral neuropathy is a major cause of foot ulcers that can lead to amputation in some people with poorly controlled diabetes. If you can't feel your feet, you're more likely to injure them and get infections in that injury. Like pollution in our metaphorical aging city, glycosylation, resulting from the diabetes we'll discuss in the next chapter, affects our proudest organs, our most critical thoroughfares, and our most beautiful traits. Its insidious nature makes it that much more dangerous.
Chapter 7. Don't be pickled by diabetes. Plenty of people, from canoodling celebrities to crooked politicians, have found themselves in some pretty public pickles. When it comes to their health, however, millions of Americans are finding themselves in their own pickles as they wrestle with the disease of diabetes. That's because when you have diabetes, the disease that's associated with blood sugar and insulin malfunction in overweight people, you're essentially pickling yourself, basting yourself in fluid that has a high concentration of sugar. The difference is that your diabetic pickle doesn't exactly go all that well with a sandwich and some chips. Diabetes serves as a microcosm of the aging process. In people with poorly controlled diabetes, a variety of degenerative diseases, such as arterial disease, heart disease, premature loss of teeth, and many other conditions, occur earlier and with greater severity than in non-diabetics. How did we get ourselves into this pickle? For a disease like diabetes to develop in the first place, it must have had a selective advantage for those who had it. In the Ice Age, it's theorized, blood sugar actually helped us. High levels of glucose were thought to prevent cells and tissues from forming ice crystals in them. Sugar is a natural antifreeze, meaning that diabetes actually would have prevented those who had it from freezing to death. Since life expectancy was low anyway, these people never had to worry about the long-term complications from diabetes that we deal with. It was simply a biologic advantage because it protected them long enough to survive the ice, reproduce, and ensure the longevity of the species. Because our bodies are designed to run on a relatively low level of glucose, when we overeat and indulge in a sedentary lifestyle, we're unable to process the extra glucose, thus pickling ourselves in all the excess, and our metabolic systems malfunction. When one of our systems, called the cannabinoid system, gets turned on, hormones in the body block the ability of insulin to get muscle to use sugar, and we accumulate sugar in our bloodstream as our metabolism actually becomes less efficient. Eventually, especially in people with family histories of type 2 diabetes, evidence of a genetic predisposition to the disease, our pancreatic beta cells, cells that produce insulin, can't keep up because of exhaustion after years of working against the relentless insulin resistance. And that's how we become diabetic. Your pancreas, function and malfunction. People with diabetes have high blood sugar either because their pancreas doesn't make enough insulin or because their muscles, fat, liver, and other cells close the door on insulin, not allowing it to deliver glucose to them. Type 1 diabetes, which is usually diagnosed in childhood but may be diagnosed at any age, occurs when the pancreas makes no insulin because of an autoimmune assault on the insulin-producing cells. People with type 1 diabetes have to replace their body's production with injections of insulin. Type 2 diabetes, formerly known as adult onset diabetes, and the focus of this chapter, is much more common, affecting more than 22 million Americans and projected to double by the year 2025. It typically occurs when your cells resist the insulin that comes knocking at their doors, leaving glucose to circulate in your bloodstream instead of being used to fuel your cells. Essentially, diabetes is a lot like a celebrity lookalike. It often gets mistaken for something it's not. A lot of us tend to think that diabetes happens because you eat too much sugar. But the truth is, diabetes happens when you eat too much. Period. Here's how. All food gets broken down into glucose. When you have insulin resistance and you overeat, be it too much meat, potato, or coconut cream pie, the cells in your body are unable to absorb the extra glucose. That causes blood glucose levels to rise higher than a helium-filled balloon. Your blood glucose level is monitored by cells in your pancreas that are the lone producers of insulin, the hormone that transports glucose from the outside to the inside of your cells so that your body can transform that glucose into usable energy. When the alarm sounds to make more insulin to help transport the extra blood glucose, the body acts like a chubby runner at the front of a marathon. It just can't keep up. Oh, it huffs and puffs and makes more insulin, but the demand is just too great. A person with type 2 diabetes has lost this glucose-insulin struggle, and so an ugly, vicious cycle begins. It made sense for us to store fat to survive when we were likely to have famines periodically or failed bison hunts. But today, that fat causes insulin resistance, which makes us eat more, which causes more fat, which is associated with eating more, so we accumulate more fat, which causes more insulin resistance, and so on. In the modern world, elevated blood sugars get you frequent flyer miles with your local doctor. Frequent urination and fatigue are symptoms, but not important problems like the other effects, such as arthritis, infections, kidney failure, accelerated arterial aging, that's heart attacks, strokes, memory problems, and impotence, damage to the peripheral nerves, and the development of vision problems that can cause blindness. Here's the major surprise for this major ager. For most people, grounding your hospital home type 2 diabetes shuttle is in your control. Just beginning to lose weight immediately shifts your body's insulin response and melts away the glycosylation. That's why this group of UTIPs is particularly useful.
UTIPs. Diabetes and its effects can steal one-third of your life. Luckily, if you can do three major things, control your blood pressure, walk 30 minutes a day, and keep your blood sugar within a narrow range, you'll practically eliminate the cardiovascular risk associated with diabetes. And that makes diabetes, the one of the scariest diseases of all, one of the most controllable. UTIP. Get your life under control. The most important things you can do to lower your risk of diabetes are to keep your waist thin, exercise daily, 30 minutes of exercise specifically, and keep your blood pressure under control. High blood pressure can really magnify the effects of diabetes by aging your arteries. Both high blood pressure and high blood sugar cause nicks or holes in the arteries' walls that trigger the destructive process of inflammation and result in atherosclerosis. Clogged arteries lack the ability to deliver blood to certain key areas, like the heart, the brain, penis, and clitoris, which leads to heart attack, stroke, impotence, and decline of orgasm quality. A little physical activity can dramatically improve the ability of insulin to get glucose into many cells, especially muscle. UTIP, add these ingredients. Of course, to prevent diabetes, you have to do the big things right. Avoid the buffet and stop planting yourself on the couch for 6 hours every evening. But little things count too. Ginseng, cinnamon, and tea have been shown to help increase insulin receptivity, which can help lower the risk of aging from diabetes. Some studies have shown that one of the substances in ginseng berries, not the root, and a half a teaspoon of cinnamon a day, can increase insulin receptivity by over 50%. The supplement chromium, at 200 micrograms a day, has been shown to increase sensitivity to insulin as well. If you do get diabetes, all is not lost. A small amount of weight loss can help make the difference between elevated blood sugar and normal blood sugar. Keeping your blood sugar and your A1C level, which is a test that shows a 3-month average of blood sugar, in the normal range, are among the most important things you can do. Diet, exercise, and medications can be combined to keep glucose and A1C levels normal. U-tip, drink coffee. Research shows that coffee can decrease insulin resistance and decrease the development of diabetes by 25%. But watch the sugar. People who add sugar to coffee or tea don't benefit and run a higher risk of developing cancer of the pancreas.
Major ager. Calorie consumption and slowing sirtuin. Understanding the ultimate anti-agers. The greatest year for aging Americans, 1935. That April, it was found that the lifespan of laboratory rats could be extended considerably by putting them on a serious calorie-restricted diet. Perhaps in response to this discovery, Congress inked the Social Security Act into law 6 months later. You'd think the rats would have been ecstatic, living longer plus retirement income. But no. Although they were living longer, the rats complained that their quality of life had declined. But since calories represent energy and energy is required to function, it wasn't surprising that the rats were tired all the time. After a few months, however, the rats felt their strength returning. The spring was back in their crawl. They were spending more and more time running on their little rat treadmills. This didn't seem to make any sense. If anything, the rats should have been dying sooner and feeling dead the rest of the time. But this wasn't happening. The rats were living 50% longer than before. Had the rodents discovered the rat chow version of the fountain of youth? The first clue came from looking at their food plan. Instead of daydreaming about how good they were going to look in a bathing suit, the rats were focused on basic survival. Instead of diet, these rats' bodies had interpreted the calorie cutback as a famine. And when the famine alarm sounded, the rats shifted into survival mode. They developed a three-pronged approach for not only surviving life's little surprises, but turning them to their advantage. Established priorities. Reproduction is at the top of the to-do list for all species, even rats. Correctly calculating that it will be hard to produce healthy little rats during stressful times, the rats' visionary genes pre-programmed the rats to shut down all efforts to reproduce if even the slightest sign of stress was detected. Although the rats' energy had come back, they suddenly realized they had all but lost their interest in sex, no dating, much less mating. The rats were definitely living longer, but they just weren't making any more rats. Keep up routine maintenance. Energy saved from delayed reproduction can now be put to work ensuring that maintenance levels are optimal. Living efficiently now to ensure that you can live vigorously later on. Focus on fuel efficiency. When a car engine is 100% efficient, all of the energy produced by the combustion of the gasoline goes directly into making the car go. Nothing is wasted. Everything gets used. The only things left over, carbon dioxide and water, are expelled through the exhaust pipe. Not exactly major pollution threats. In the current real world, our car engines are only 20% efficient. So for 5 gallons of gas, only 1 gallon, 20%, is actually used to power the car. The rest creates a lot of heat and combines to make a lot of nasties that end up as air pollution. If combustion is 100% efficient, there are no free radicals and no air pollution. As combustion becomes less efficient, free radicals increase proportionately. Now, inside of our cells, the process of cellular respiration breaks down a molecule of glucose into carbon dioxide, water, and energy. This energy is stored as ATP. The adult human produces 150 pounds of ATP a day. It's your gasoline. The process breaking down sugar is no different from the process of combustion in the car. In cellular respiration, sugars are literally burned up, just as the car burns gasoline. And just as in the car, the burning of glucose is not completely efficient. About 40% of the energy and food is converted into ATP. Some of the unburned sugar leaks out and creates free radicals, just as in the car. These cellular pollutants cause a lot of damage. A car has an engine, and cells have the mitochondria. As gasoline is fuel to the car, protein, fat, and carbohydrates are fuel to your body. But all fuels are not created equal. Rocket fuel has pound for pound about 5 times the energy of regular gas. And in the cell, burning fat produces 2 to 3 times as much energy as burning sugar. When the rat's calories are cut back, they start relying more on fat stores as a fuel source. Since fat combustion is several times more efficient at producing ATP than burning glucose, the same amount of energy can be created with much lower levels of free radicals. Fewer free radicals means lower levels of free radical damage, particularly to the mitochondria. Recent studies have shown that a calorie restriction of 40% leads to a 45% decrease in the rate of mitochondrial free radical generation and a 30% reduction in the level of oxidative damage to mitochondrial DNA. The net effect of these changes decreases the rate of aging by about 50%. Unfortunately, humans cannot live reasonably by cutting 40% of their calorie intake, because all they would think about is food. Fortunately, just cutting back by 15% gets you almost as much anti-aging benefit. This is why you can incorporate this approach instead of the tougher 25% reduction that is often used by calorie restriction zealots. Cert yourself. When it comes to calorie restriction, the mechanism that slows aging comes in the form of a protein called sirtuin. Sirtuin seems to change the chemistry in your body to help neutralize aging. In animal models, we see that sirtuin is really a magic molecule because it allows primates to have an even longer life expectancy than full house reruns. Not everyone's sirtuin protein manufacturing gene is activated. Researchers have found that calorie restriction helps activate sirtuin. That is, eating fewer calories acts as the light switch that turns on sirtuin. The way sirtuin works is by influencing the way DNA is made. DNA is encased in proteins called histones, which stabilize the structure of the DNA. But when the sirtuin gene is activated through the starvation stimulus, the resulting increased activity of sirtuin protein compresses the DNA on the histones and thus slows the way that the chromosomes are reproduced and reduces errors during the process. The main way sirtuin is activated is through restricting calories, but it's also done through heat shock as a survival mechanism. When animals are exposed to extremely hot water, sirtuin kicks in to help them survive the shock and live on. Sirtuin production can also be turned on by other things, resveratrol in wine being a biggie, as well as quercetin in apples and onions, and physical activity, and may end up being the ultimate anti-ager of them all.
Chapter 8. Get great guts. Considering all the other life-threatening health problems we tend to worry about, it may seem that digestive distress ranks somewhere between canker sores and bunions in the pecking order of age-related problems. But the truth is that there's a whole world inside your gut that influences how you age. When you eat too much and engage in the major ager of excessive calorie consumption, you don't allow the ultimate anti-ager, calorie restriction, to give you the benefits of longevity. Plus, perhaps no other system influences how you feel as much as your digestive system, especially when conditions such as reflux disease and constipation are as common today as reality TV. And that's why getting a good handle on the area between your love handles is important. Understand the range of digestive issues, some of which actually start in the brain, and you'll be taking a major step in slowing down the aging process. You can't avoid it. the stealth system of hunger. Anybody who's ever tried to lose weight knows that it's like trying to swim upstream against a strong current. If you just let go and do nothing, you'll drift away and get zero accomplished. But you also know that there are only two ways to make it back upstream. You have to either change the rate at which you swim or change the rate of the current. People who make changes in their lifestyle are, in effect, changing the rate at which they swim. Some people are able to successfully navigate the waters and break through the strong currents with their eating and exercising habits. But others, no matter how hard they swim, can't fight the current. So physics would dictate that the only way those swimmers can win is to change the rate of the current, that is, to change their biology, so that it's easier for them to swim upstream. In this case, the rate of the current comes in the form of a system that helps explain why some people have more problems with obesity than others. It's called the cannabinoid system. Cannabinoids are like traffic lights. When they're always green and don't restrict traffic into an area, then it gets too crowded and traffic worsens. A more efficient system is one in which there's a steady alternation of red and green lights to efficiently manage all the traffic that's coming from different directions. Research into cannabinoids, which are hormones made from omega-6 fatty acids primarily in the liver and kidney, started when scientists wanted to know why marijuana caused the munchies. Marijuana being the cannabis plant, hence the name. And what they found? The cannabinoid system has receptors that can be produced and destroyed quickly. The ones in the brain make you stalk the fridge at midnight. But the more dangerous receptors are actually produced in omental fat. That's the fat around your belly. Essentially, cannabinoids hinder the ability of insulin to push sugar into cells, so we don't burn the sugar, and we end up insulin resistant. Cannabinoids do this by blocking a substance called adiponectin, produced by fat cells, which normally allows muscle to use carbs and fats effectively. This probably explains why some people gain weight and others burn calories more readily, and probably also explains why some are often hungrier when they get fatter, since a brain that doesn't have sugar pushed into it still senses hunger. Cannabinoids also bias you towards fatty foods and sugars, meaning that your can't-avoid system pushes you to eat hedonistically. That type of binge doesn't simply happen because you're stressed or because you've been working like a Tasmanian devil to finish a project, or sad because of some struggles in your relationship, or mad because your favorite idol got kicked off. That's part of it, sure. But the biological basis for food binges is that your cannabinoid system causes uncontrollable urges that drive you to the foods that, in effect, will make your waist protrude like a baking cake, just like malfunctioning traffic lights cause cars to jam up inefficiently. But this is more than just an issue of crowding or obesity. It's an issue of morbidity. Cannabinoids also stimulate the liver to make more fat, so our triglyceride and LDL levels become elevated, another risk factor for things like high blood pressure, diabetes, and heart disease. And they stimulate the brain to increase food intake, which leads to abdominal obesity, which leads to insulin resistance and glucose intolerance. Since it doesn't seem to do much good, why would we even need this cannabinoid system? Good question. Its purpose is to calm us after periods of stress, which in prehistoric times usually coincided with a lack of food. So at the same time the cannabinoids told our brain to relax and stop pumping out steroids in response to panic, they also stimulated us to store whatever food we might have nearby. You would never guess where. The lucky omentum, a fat-storing organ around your stomach, soaks up excess steroids released during stress. And these steroids help the omentum fat cells bulk up like a mini Thanksgiving Day float. In a way, cannabinoids work a little bit like a middle manager of hormones that control hunger. Cannabinoids have some influence over the many different signals that get your brain to eat, some coming from the stomach and some coming from hormonal regulators in the brain. They can influence how other hormones work and how fast you feel hungry. But the pot-smoking munchies are only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the potential insight we can gain from studying cannabinoids. If we can understand how certain chemicals turn hunger signals on and off, we can understand how people can stop being hungry and lose weight. Back to our swimming analogy. If you can train yourself to swim upstream or slow the current, you're going to have much better success in managing your waste long term. You have a couple of options, including strenuous exercise, which trains your muscles to use energy and restrict calories, especially unhealthy amounts of omega-6 fatty acids that give rise to these cannabinoids. However, about 20% of obese people will fail even when they try the correct steps, and they may benefit from cannabinoid receptor blocking drugs that are in development. These have decreased weight more than twice as much as just restricting calories alone, meaning it actually increases your metabolism. Plus, this receptor blocking substance decreases the morbidities from obesity twice as much as could be expected from weight loss alone. It's like the traffic moving twice as fast when the broken traffic signals are fixed. The food freeway, your gut. We tend to think of digestion as an easy math equation with three different answers. When you add food to your body, it can go in one of three directions. 1, burned up and uses energy for your body. 2, stored up and turned into fat on your body. Or 3, churned up and eliminated out of your body. Now, let's take a look inside to see how we get to those three possible endpoints. When food enters your mouth, your glands secrete saliva to start digestion. Saliva also helps protect the teeth and gums from bacterial infection by inhibiting bacterial growth, and it spreads the taste all around your mouth, important for satisfaction. As you get older, that saliva tends to dry up, leading to the dry mouth, lip-smacking that you may hear when older people talk. It's one of the reasons why drinking plenty of fluid can help combat the effects of aging. During this process of salivation, and as food travels down the esophagus, calories and nutrients start to come out of the food into you. How does it travel? Not through gravity or little food-carrying gremlins, but through a process called peristalsis, a rhythmic contraction of smooth muscle in your gut that moves a lump of food, called the bolus, down through the esophagus and into the intestines. The gut, by the way, is what docs term the totality of the tubes from your mouth through your esophagus, stomach, small intestine, large intestine, and rectum. For up to 75% of people, peristalsis slows with age. The reason is because the number of neurons in our gut drops by half. When you don't have the normal nerve-firing sequences to control peristalsis, food doesn't move through the system smoothly, leading to indigestion and constipation. In a good system, the food moves like toothpaste through the tube if you're squeezing from the very end. In people with slowed peristalsis, it's like you're pushing the paste out from the middle of the tube, so the pattern becomes irregular, choppy, and unpredictable. And we certainly don't have to tell you what irregular, choppy, and unpredictable movements in your gut feel like. Digestion is regulated by many chemicals, including one called 5-HT, a precursor to the feel-good chemical serotonin. It can be controlled by drugs that stimulate the serotonin system. When they're working correctly, these aid digestion by stimulating more neurons, releasing nitric oxide, which aids anal relaxation, and releasing a substance called acetylcholine, which helps stimulate colon contractions so you can go to the bathroom. It also allows you to move gas through the intestines without sensing discomfort. As food enters your stomach from the esophagus, your stomach mixes it up. Your stomach serves as your body's washing machine, mixing food with acids, breaking apart foods into different nutrients. As you age, you not only have less digestive fluid in your stomach, but the fluid you do have has less acidity. That may seem like a good thing, but it means your body has a weakened ability to jackhammer out the proteins it needs for normal functioning. That's one of the reasons why pharmaceuticals have very different effects as you age. Think of your 23-foot-long small intestines as an underwater cave with coral, the coral being the finger-shaped villi that line the inner walls of your intestines and act like little sponges, sucking up nutrients. As you get older, those villi become rocky and ragged and dulled, so they're less able to absorb nutrients, although they are still great at absorbing calories. And you can imagine what that does. A decreased ability to absorb calcium means an increased chance that you'll experience bone loss. A decreased ability to absorb vitamin B12 or folate or niacin or vitamin C and E may mean an increased risk of neurological deficit or damage from free radicals. Other common GI problems associated with age include swallowing disorders. Because peristalsis slows down with age, you're more likely to get reflux, making swallowing more difficult. It's important not only to limit your portions, but to slow down when you eat. And as Mom said, stop talking with your mouth full. Diverticulitis, which are small pouches in the intestinal wall that form when you have too little fiber and water, and your intestines are forced to squeeze too hard, and so are you when you're going to the bathroom. Feces can then get stuck in these pouches, creating GI discomfort. The answer? You got it. More fiber plus more water equals less straining. Urinary incontinence. Though technically not part of the GI system, we've included it here because it's awfully close and often associated with aging. What happens is that as a woman ages and experiences a decline in muscle strength, she actually loses the ability to control her bladder. That's because the muscles around the bladder, typically suspended from the pelvic floor, are supposed to constrict the urethra tube that goes from the bladder to the outside world. But if the muscles become flaccid, meaning you don't have as much control of the kink, then laughing or coughing can build up pressure on the bladder and force urine out. Weakness often happens due to the stretch that pregnancy causes. Doing Kegel exercises can help strengthen those muscles. By the way, the same mechanism is at work with bowel incontinence, only the muscle tone comes from the rectum, as well as surrounding muscles. Kegel exercises don't help here, but rectal tampons have been developed by some entrepreneurial sufferers. Aging of our intestines can sabotage our anti-aging crusade by simultaneously causing malnourishment and obesity. What a combo! And by forming a healthy alliance with nutrient-rich foods, the gut also holds some of our greatest opportunities to halt our major agers.
U-tips. Deciding what to put in your mouth and what not to greatly influences how quickly your digestive system ages. By taking these steps, you'll keep your innards running smoothly, so you can too. U-tip, add bulk. The food duo with the most muscle, fiber, and water. Together they keep your food bulky and soft, so it can move easily through your system without putting too much pressure on your intestines. Without water, fiber often turns to cement. Containing no calories but still making you feel full, fiber combined with water helps your digestive system and your overall health because it helps keep you from eating the other things that are more likely to lead to problems associated with obesity, like heart disease and diabetes. Fiber is found in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, oats, beans, and some cereals. Your goal? 35 grams a day for women and 25 grams a day for men. U-tip, shower your insides. Of all the reasons H2O is oh so good, the work it does for your guts is one of the best. For starters, it helps lubricate everything so food can slide through more easily. Plus, it helps quell hunger, fights bad breath, and helps you avoid dry mouth. Your mechanism for detecting thirst doesn't work as well when you're older, which makes it that much more important to remind yourself to drink regularly throughout the day before your body even tells you it's time. U-tip, play the elimination game. The best way to experiment with foods that may be causing you general digestive irritation is to do the food elimination test. For 3 days in a row, eliminate certain groups of food from your diet, dairy products, wheat products, and sugars being the top three. Write down how you feel during those days and notice any change in digestive feelings as well as things like your energy level. The test will give you insight not only into allergies specifically, but into food irritabilities, symptoms that can make you feel like you have a touch of the flu. Another bonus. Learning to eliminate certain groups, sugars and refined carbohydrates especially, can also help you lose weight.
Major ager, neurotransmitter imbalance, how the chemical message system in your brain can age you. In a society that sends and receives messages at an Indy 500 pace, we're all well aware of the advantages and disadvantages of the communication process. Sometimes we get messages instantaneously. Sometimes it takes longer. Sometimes we get too many messages. Sometimes messages are like socks in the laundry. they can get lost in some other world. Now take the same concept and apply it to your brain. It's in the business of sending and receiving messages that help dictate how you act, how you feel, whether you want to be asleep, or whether you're craving a triple chocolate deep-fried Hades-worthy dessert. How? Well, the nerves of your body communicate through spaces called synapses. They're the gaps between the end of one nerve cell and the beginning of another. Your body has about 2 times 10 to the 14th synapses. Most of the communications between nerves use substances called neurotransmitters, which are chemicals that help send a signal across a synapse. Think of these neurotransmitters as a one-way electrical impulse between nerves. When one nerve wants to communicate to a neighboring nerve, it releases neurotransmitters. These neurotransmitters have keys to your neurological mailboxes, which are called neuron receptors, and only the messages with the right keys will fit into the receptors. Once the key is in the lock, a lot of things can happen. It can allow glucose in or out, or it can cause a muscle to contract, or it can make you want to go to sleep. So some messages may make nerves excited, while other neurotransmitters may slow or depress neuron activity. It depends on what messages are being sent and how, and even if they're being received. While the message transport system is important, so is the receiver system. The receptors determine where the keys fit and can even determine whether or not you're getting too much of a neurotransmitter. Your neuron receptors, and this is where it all comes together, can be modified by the drugs you take or the foods you eat, making them more or less effective in the long run. In addition, prolonged exposure to a certain neurotransmitter, even if it's bad for you, can cause receptors to be unresponsive. The entire neurological system is protected by something called the blood-brain barrier, a set of tightly packed cells that acts as a kind of a filter system, protecting the brain. One of the reasons why many supplements are useless is because they can't get into the brain to have an effect. As you age, your brain actually shrinks, and you lose a little bit of brain power. You also lose some of the neurotransmitters you produce. Average levels of serotonin and dopamine each decline about 5% every 10 years, and that's been linked to emotional issues like depression, as well as other cognitive abilities, like how well you sleep, which is the subject of our next chapter. Aging of the brain has also been linked to problems with major age or toxins influencing the message system of neurotransmitters, through such things as industrial-sized doses of MSG, for example. The good part, however, is that food and exercise and sleep work as dials on your neurotransmitter radio, regulating how you feel from day to day and hour to hour, and thus can have a profound impact on the emotional side of aging. Events controlled by neurotransmitters, like insomnia, also affect longevity, not just the quality of life.
Chapter 9. Sleep your way to the top. With all due respect to your favorite recliner or antique armoire, is there a finer piece of furniture than your bed? Really? In a way, your bed is one of life's few sanctuaries. It's a place where you can retreat with your own thoughts, or where you can be naked with the love of your life, or where you can be entertained and inspired by a dream that includes a dentist, a tornado, and a three-legged unicorn that speaks Croatian. Why, then, is it that we have so little regard for this sanctuary of solitude? It's not as if we don't love sleep. In fact, despite a few key differences, sleep is like another popular bedroom activity in more ways than one. We all want more of it, we can't wait for it to start, and we hate to see it end. And we're none too happy being interrupted in the middle of it. But the truth is that most of us don't get enough sleep, and most of us think that a lack of sleep is no big deal. We go on our way, trudging through our daily lives and responsibilities, tired, defeated, sluggish, caffeine-infused, and longing to sledgehammer the alarm clock at 6:07 every morning. Simply, few of us are losing sleep about losing sleep. Not sleeping is not merely making you more agitated than an out-of-balance washing machine it could be killing you. Sensing sleep, your third eye. Moms may have back of their heads eyes, arrested celebrities may get black eyes, and adulterers may have wandering eyes. But we all have another kind of eye that plays a role in how we age. It's our third eye, and it's located deep inside the middle of our brain, in the exact center of our brain, actually. Our pineal gland senses when we're exposed to light, much in the way that a security-type light sensor does. The pineal gland has cells that resemble the back of the retina, but it is nestled deep in our brain, far away from any direct access to light. It likely senses light through special receptors in the backs of our eyes that don't actually provide vision, but do dictate our circadian rhythms. Even the blind have this rhythm, indicating that our pineals, along with other neurological inputs, can substitute for these special cells in our eyes. We know that the pineal gland plays a role in aging because research has shown that putting young pineal glands in old animals helps reverse aging. The old animals' hair grew thicker and lusher when the new pineals were inserted. By contrast, putting old pineal glands in young animals quickens their aging process. To live longer and healthier, you need to know about the pineal gland because it produces a substance called melatonin, which conducts the symphony of your hormones. Melatonin modulates menstruation, helps control the desire for mating, helps lower heart rate and blood pressure, increases immune function, and helps decrease stress by blocking the body's stress response. Plus, it helps regulate sleep. If you're a trivia expert, you may remember melatonin as the neurotransmitter that helps bears hibernate. Its levels peak at night and during winter months. Serotonin, which converts to melatonin, helps regulate our daytime activity. When the lights go out, your pineal senses that and starts producing melatonin. When you lose melatonin, which is also found in the gut, by the way, you lose your normal sleep pattern, which then cascades into a host of health problems. The reason we're concerned about it here? Our own melatonin loses some of its potency as we age. Our receptors for that neurotransmitter, you knew we'd link it with a major ager, didn't you? Don't create the same power from the dose of melatonin they receive. As you get older, you also lose some of the oomph you get from melatonin, which may explain why so many of us suffer age-related sleep and health problems. In fact, melatonin production peaks around age 5 and starts a downhill slide from there. Unfortunately, we lose up to 80% of those original levels by the time we reach 60. And that's likely one of the reasons we don't sleep as well when we get older and why great Aunt Teresa is up at 4:30 every morning. Melatonin evolved for us to sense light and dark, as well as changes in season, because our circadian rhythms help regulate our reproductive rhythms. Originally, nature tried to schedule the occurrence of births at a time of year when the odds of survival for mother and baby were the greatest. That is when the days are long and the nights are short and the food supply is the greatest. So melatonin cycles meant more babies were conceived to be born in spring. Now, you probably also know the word melatonin.